This Monday.com ad was created by a team of people and AI agents. The agents wrote the copy and managed the timelines, while our human creative director made sure it all made sense. Easy. Create your own AI agent today on Monday.com.
At the 1987 Australian Touring Car Championship, there was a new car on the track. It wasn't as big as the other cars, and it didn't put out as much horsepower as the other cars, but it was driven by Jim Richards, who had dominated the year before at the Australian Endurance Championship in a BMW 635i. But this time around, Richards was piloting a BMW E30. The all-new BMW had once been a bland street version of the E30, but the M Group at BMW had pulled every bolt, washer, and piston and replaced them with ultra-light versions while tweaking the output. The fresh S14 motor made just shy of 200 horsepower, almost half of the rest of the lineup in the race. But the chassis was something special. It was so well-crafted that the little BMW, weighing 1,000 pounds less than Richard's last ride, felt like it was locked onto rails. The white BMW wound its way through the crowd of heavy V8 touring cars and eventually conquered the entire series. Across the globe, other racing series were seeing the same results. BMW M3s crafted out of E30s, winning checkered flag after checkered flag. It wasn't long before the M3 was coming head-to-head with its entire reason for existence. The Mercedes-Benz 190E, the little Benz that had been crushing the competition across Group A. How did a glorified bicycle launch one of the most lived racing programs in history? How did a handful of Mercedes engineers inspire one of the greatest touring cars ever made? How did BMW turn the E30 into a global superpower? Today, it's part two of the BMW versus Benz in Group A series on Pass Gas.
Ooh, baby!
Welcome back to Pass Gas, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes. Across from me today, big BMW guy, it's Max Maddox.
Hi, everybody. I have three BMWs.
Yes, you do.
How many of them work?
At all?
How many of them drive and work all the way?
I'd say all of them work.
Okay.
In terms of me getting in them and driving them. One of them's on a battery tender. Always.
Okay.
One of them has a couple windows that don't roll down.
Yes.
One of them has a different window that doesn't roll down.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all...
They're functional.
Generally they're all functional.
One of them stops in traffic when the AC is on?
Yeah, it does turn off if the AC is on, but that's fine.
Okay, well,
that's
we can deliberate what functional actually means all day. I'd love to do that. But I'm going to introduce our next host here. We got Christina Felski on the pod.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. Had a long weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't do jack.
That's
just
great.
Played my video games.
Yeah, what video game are you playing currently?
Well, I finished Ghost of Tsushima from Sucker Punch. Great, great game. For some reason, put that off for years, and I am regretting it. It's one of the best games I've ever played.
Wow.
And then I bought College Football 25, and I'm gonna take my San Diego State Aztecs to victory. I chose them because none of the schools that I went to NAU at first, Northern Arizona. They don't have Division II teams, I think, in the game, so I couldn't play as the Lumberjacks.
Mm.
And then I wanted to choose my hometown team, San Luis Obispo, Cal Poly SLO, the Mustangs, also Division II in the Big Sky League. They don't have that either. So hopefully a patch, I can play as the Mustangs, and I can turn things around.
Wait, so
my sister went to San Diego State, so that's why I chose the
Aztecs. I was going to say, is the school you went to didn't have a football team?
Then Northridge, which I graduated from, we didn't have a football team.
The Matadors.
Okay.
I went to Loyola in Chicago, did not have a football team.
Yeah. SF State, no football team.
Whoa! Yeah. Look at us now.
We had a good soccer team, though. Our soccer team crushed it, and our basketball team was pretty good, too.
SF State, women's soccer.
Our mascot is we're the Ramblers.
The Ramblers?
Yes. Originally, it was represented by a hobo with a little rucksack.
Of course, yeah. A little handkerchief on a stick.
Toe coming out of his boot.
Like, have beans, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
By the time I was there, it was a wolf. And I was like, that's weird. And everyone's like, do you know what it actually was originally?
That's so crazy. You'd think a school in Chicago...
The Loyola Italian beef would be amazing.
Yes, that would be. I thought you were going to say you think they wouldn't be that offensive, and I was going to say, well, we do have the Blackhawks. So.
I was going to say, I mean, that's extraordinarily progressive to change that mascot.
I know.
The hobo with the stick.
Which, by the way, hobo is not a derogatory term. No, it's not a derogatory term.
Oh, okay.
It isn't.
Great. Well, yeah, I'm going to say it all the time now, then.
Yeah, I wanted to do that. I mean, obviously, like, my punk phase. And so I wanted to. I wanted to do.
You wanted
train
to
hopping.
Do that too.
Yeah.
What was the appeal? I guess some freedom. Movement.
I like traveling, so I was like, oh, if I hop on a train, I can just go.
It's just dangerous.
It's definitely dangerous. I think I also have a very strong case of, well, if a boy can do it, I can do it.
Right.
So I've got that.
Did you learn all the symbols that like?
I read a bunch of like anarchist books.
Got crew change.
So I know some.
I learned some of those symbols from, I think, like an Uncle John's bathroom reader book where it's like, hey, if you see a cat drawn on an underpass or something, that means there's a kind lady nearby who will take you in on your travels. Like,
whoa.
Stuff like that. Yeah.
I met a train hopper in college who offered me DMT out of a light bulb.
Oh, out of a light bulb. How exotic. Yeah. Did you take him off on it?
No.
That's fun.
I saw the face of God thanks to a light bulb.
Yeah. Jeez. No thanks.
We're talking BMWs today.
That's right. Yes. We're talking BMWs today. Right. We brought in Jimmy was here last week.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, missed some flights. This is dating the podcast a little bit, but there's a whole CrowdStrike glitch.
If you're a Big Three listener, you would have heard this a couple weeks ago, but all the guys got completely boned out in Texas.
Stuck in, I think, Austin or something, or San Antonio.
Literally everyone did. Like Adam, too, I think, because he was racing.
He was over in St. Louis.
So, I think he's still in St. Louis.
So we called an audible, football term, and brought in one of our resident BMW heads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I have an E30 that I've
owned. You have a sick E30.
Yeah, I've had it for 14 years, and it's finally at a point where I think it's really, really, really fun.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about
I'm
sure.
Be as fun as a M3, though?
Yeah, I think it would. I think it would. It totally would.
All right. Well, let's.
It absolutely would. It
let's decide.
Smoke an M3 like a damn Christmas ham. But let's get into the little race cars.
Just a little refresher here for everybody. Last week, we talked about Mercedes and their foray into Group A racing with the 190E, how that came together. Now we're seeing the other side of the rivalry with BMW. This is BMW's episode here. And then next week, they'll come together.
In a cacophonous jubilee, you might say.
That was a great phrase.
Thank you. Jubilee. It came off. I don't know from whence it came, but
well, you studied
it,
English,
it came
right?
Whence.
You studied English at Loyola, so
I sure do. Yeah. I have a creative writing degree, and you know what? I use it.
You
so
sure do.
Take
Holy
that, Dad.
Shit. Okay. Okay. So, tested in sport, proven in series is a slogan BMW has used for almost 100 years now. While it probably sounds better in German, it's been the ethos of the automotive company since the start. By the 1930s, BMW had carved a name for themselves in the halls of motorcycle racing history. We've talked about this before on the show, I believe. Before the Nazis descended on Europe, BMW had racked up wins from Switzerland to the south of France. Rider George Meyer, I think we talked about him specifically, was the first non-Brit to win the Senior TT at the Isle of Man on a supercharged BMW bike.
Damn, 1930s supercharged motorcycle.
That sounds terrifying.
On the Isle of Man.
And that's when, like, if you crashed... They were going to give you a piece of wood to bite on and chop a limb off.
They would not identify your body. So these wins solidified BMW as the ultimate sport bike champion by the end of the 1930s. This success, perhaps unfortunately, caught the eye of one Adolf Hitler. As the Nazis rose to power, he demanded BMW produce all the motorcycles for his soldiers. As the 30s dragged on, BMW started venturing into auto racing. They started with the prestigious BMW 328, which housed a now typical for the company 2-liter inline six-cylinder engine, which pushed out a respectable 79 horsepower. A racer known as AFP Fane drove the tiny BMW 328 to a victory in the sports car class at the Grossglockner Hill Climb, which was kind
well
of
done.
A, yeah, thank you, which was a sort of German Pikes Peak. And then went on to snag a win at the 2-liter class in the Mille Miglia over
AFP
there in Italy.
AFP Fane, that's cool. AFP it's like a SoundCloud Fane, name.
I was going to say. 2 years later, Fritz Sitted Egno Werner von Hahnstein, known to his friends as Huske von Hahnstein, drove the same 328 to a massive victory at the Midland Miglia, so BMW is doing well.
I feel the need to say that German names are not inherently funny, but this name is inherently funny to me.
Huschke von Hohenstein.
Like, they didn't give him, like, bub. No. You know what I mean? They didn't give him, like, some kind of, like, even just, like, Hohenstein.
They gave him some
Hans.
A regal kind of nature.
They gave him a full three words.
Yes.
Anyway.
Unfortunately, that victory wasn't enough to keep Hitler from converting the BMW factory to produce nothing but motorcycles for his troops, specifically the sidecar-equipped R75, which has become legendary for its durability and swiftness in combat. Legendary to who?
Yeah. A lot of people.
Mm. Side note, the bike also caught the eye of American troops, who later went to Harley-Davidson to get their own non-Nazi version of the Nazi motorcycle, and the result was called the Harley XA.
Huh.
The Harley XA is pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
That's pretty badass.
Dude, it's got a freaking leather holster for a rifle on the fork.
I don't imagine that comes standard, but I do like it.
That's super sick. Put a freaking M1 carbine in there. Nice. During World War II, BMW and the rest of the fascist war machine had their nose to the grindstone as they pumped out motorcycles and aircraft engines. The Nazis declared BMW an armament company. So, as the war chugged along, American and British forces bombed BMW's factories into warm puddles of slag and steel.
Puddles of slag.
You know, that's what Puddle of Mud wanted to call their band.
Mm.
But they thought it seemed like they were saying slag, like how British people say slag.
Oh.
And they were like,
birds are slag. Oh, bosh.
Anyway.
Meanwhile, at Mercedes headquarters, the board of directors and workers weren't dealing with the same sort of death and destruction. Mercedes was just a regular company pumping out regular cars for Nazi bigwigs. As the fog of war cleared, Mercedes continued their work on building cars and got back to the business of racing without delay. But over at BMW, they were dealing with the optics of being an official Nazi weapons company, which almost destroyed them. To stay afloat, BMW had to temporarily use their factories to make pots and pans.
I mean,
I'm sure there's some real interesting people who want their hands on those post-war, definitely not Nazi, pots and pans.
Yeah.
Like Jesse James.
Yes. Jesse James' large collection of BMW pots and pans.
I mean, he loves Nazi stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so does Marilyn Manson, unsurprisingly.
Hmm. You know, if BMW can come back from this, I got to think we're going to be okay, guys. I feel really confident about the fact that we will come back from this. I mean, come on, dude.
At least we didn't make... we weren't making bikes for the Nazis.
That's true. That's a pretty big mark on the old record there. We'll be right back after this.
This Monday.com ad was created by a team of people and AI agents. The agents wrote the copy and managed the timelines, while our human creative director made sure it all made sense. Easy. Create your own AI agent today on Monday.com.
For years after the war, there was no racing and no fancy cars. BMW was scrambling to stay alive while the rest of the world dismantled their factories to pay reparations to the victims of the Nazis. It wasn't until 1951 that BMW was able to get a car off the assembly line. Like many manufacturers after World War II, the car that got them out of the post-war slump was a utilitarian fleet vehicle. BMW debuted the 501, which became the default cop car in Germany for years. Man, what are they doing?
This is...
and helped keep the factory line rolling.
This is an ugly car.
The 501?
Yeah, this is an ugly car.
Really, it's got the really
it's
tall...
It's round, it's bulgy.
Oh.
And by the way, huge kidney grills, which is something people complain about today, but apparently that's actually a throwback to this.
In 1956, BMW released the 507, a small coupe designed to directly compete with the all-new Corvette in looks and speed. But it cost too much to make, and Americans weren't totally on board with buying German cars yet.
You know who bought one?
Hmm.
Elvis.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Elvis had a 507.
I don't mind the look of this one. It looks like a Pixar car to me quite a bit. Mainly because it's like grimacing and it's got its little headlight eyes.
It's better than the last one, though.
It sure is. That is true. BMW just couldn't catch a break, and by 1959, there were rumors swirling that Mercedes-Benz was about to buy BMW and convert their factories to building Benzes.
Damn.
I've heard this before.
Yes. Yeah, it was like this was the very end, and then they got it together, which we'll talk about. But luckily, BMW received investments from individuals and the German government, doesn't hurt, which kept the company afloat and out of their competitors' hands. During this time, BMW employees and former factory racers watched with disdain as Mercedes kept winning races, and BMW employees were forced to make those aforementioned pots and pans. Mm. That would be such a bummer if you were like, oh, we know we could compete, but we're making pots and pans instead of the cars.
Yeah.
Because we were forced to be Nazis, kind of,
you know,
seemingly.
Those BMW pots and pans, that would be pretty cool, but...
They just have huge kidney grills on the bottom. And
yeah, like, right.
This doesn't work.
They're exceedingly normal.
This doesn't work. Nothing stays in the pots and pans.
These are exceedingly normal.
A BMW, the roundel on the handle, though?
That'd be cool.
Sick.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool.
Now we're cooking.
Okay. On the racing side, BMW released a sleek roadster based on their compact 700 called the 700 RS.
Back to being a little uglier again.
Mm.
I concur.
This is like the type of bed that looks like a car.
It's a bit Porsche 356. Is that the roadster? I think so.
Yeah.
A bit Porsche 356 with like a pointier nose.
And a big behind. It's got a big old behind.
So this thing had 69 horsepower coming from its 700cc flat twin motor.
Huh.
Oh, what the hell?
Wow. Now,
it wasn't the fastest car on the grid, but it was a car. Around this time, BMW introduced the new class in the form of the 1500, which we'll talk about more in a little bit. The new class had a lot of innovative hallmarks of the BMW that we know and love today, but it was different from other cars at the time. The new class was blocky, with BMW's distinct kidney grille and the Hofmeister kink.
I got a Hofmeister kink.
God, Max.
This was the first time that it was used in design. The Hofmeister kink, as Max alluded to, is a reference to the former BMW director of body engineering and development, Wilhelm Hofmeister, who actually was not a designer, but an engineer and division manager. But at the time, the body development division manager was also the de facto head of design. Though Hofmeister did not invent the distinctive kink, as it had made its appearance on Italian and U.S.-made cars in the 1940s, it was a defining look for BMW. So how do we describe the Hofmeister kink?
The rear window, when it meets the corners.
Yeah.
At the C-pillar of the car, normally would be kind of like a, you know, meet at an angle. This is an upwards facing swoop that you'd recognize it if you see it.
Let's say it's like a like two points of direction change, basically, right? Instead of just being like a acute angle, like you mentioned, Max, there's like it goes up and then there's like two kinks. There's two angles, right?
It looks like a C to me.
It turns the window instead of being a triangle into more of a rhombus.
More of a rhombus.
Adds a side.
It's rhombic.
It's rhombic in nature.
Mm-hmm. Rhombus.
Yes.
Yes.
Wow. Rhombuses? That's my Hofmeister kink. BMW launched the blocky 1500 New Class in the early 1960s as a compact executive car. Baron Alex von Falkenhausen, who was responsible for turning the 1930s BMW 328 into a racing legend, was asked to put together a new engine for the New Class of BMW sports cars. The request that hit his desk was to build a 1.3-liter engine, but von Falkenhausen instead designed a modular, almost modular, 1.5-liter that could easily be expanded to 2 liters and beyond, which is why the motor lasted as long as it did. This was the first four-cylinder built by BMW since 1936 and would launch the foundation of not only what would become BMW Group A Racing, but the future of BMW altogether.
That's foreshadowing.
Wink, wink. This clever motor and well-designed compact sedan carried the company to multiple back-to-back Le Mans wins. The model 1800 Ti won the 1965 24 Hours of Spa, and the upgraded 2000 Ti took the 24 Hours of Spa title in 1966. That same year, the same car conquered the European Touring Car Challenge. This thing looks sick as hell.
2000 Ti. That's like a real BMW that people will have.
Oh,
still,
that's the 2000.
Yeah, that's the BMW 2000. Mm-hmm.
That's the guy.
It's
nice.
Yeah, I mean, this is when they start getting really good looking to me. Like, the rest of this, I'm like, oh, God.
They made a two-door version of this, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a two-door, and the early ones had those beautiful, roundy taillights. Great-looking car.
Dude, very cool-looking car. In 1972, with this all-new swagger and high on the fumes of multiple Spa-Francorchamps wins, BMW launched BMW Motorsport GmbH, more commonly referred to as M. While AMG was launched in a garage by disgruntled Mercedes employees who just wanted to hit the track, M was designed from the start to be a fully supported wing of the BMW mothership, designed to capitalize on the upwards momentum of the new class of race cars stacking up victories.
Hell yeah.
I love the 2000. You know, I think I would put this on my must own list at some point.
A 2000?
Yeah.
I mean, you get
probably
one.
Look ridiculous, and they're tiny cars. But
your arms would be out both windows.
Yeah. I saw a Great Dane one time in an In-N-Out drive-through where his tail was sticking out one window and his head was sticking out the other, and I feel like it'd be a similar kind of look for me.
That's
in this car.
A
2002, an older one, smog exempt. You can
do 2002.
Whatever you want to.
That's the one I'm thinking of.
We're getting there. Yeah.
But 2002s, dude. Those are sick.
We'll be right back after this bit of housekeeping.
This Monday.com ad was created by a team of people and AI agents. Reese, our content agent, wrote the copy based on our best practices, like mentioning Monday.com 3 times. That was the second. Johnny, our coordination agent, built the timeline and kept everyone aligned. Olivia, our human creative director, stayed in the loop because agents are great, but they don't always know when a joke lands. She had one note: tell listeners it only takes minutes to build an agent. So, minutes. Create your own AI agent today on Monday.com.
One of the first projects of M was to tackle the somewhat stale E9, which is a beautiful car, by the way, the Batmobile, they call it, which had been built on the back of the successful BMW 2000, but hadn't succeeded in the same way.
The E9 is what Chris Evans drives in Knives Out.
The original?
That's right. He's got that sick-ass. Oh, dude, so good. Mike Burrows had one at one point, which he was stanced out E9.
That's sick as hell.
Very, very, very cool. The group chopped up the E9 and shoved an M30, an inline six based on von Falkenhausen's M10, under the hood so they could qualify for homologation and get racing as fast as possible in the European Touring Car Championship under Group 2, later called Group A, rules.
So they took that little, the modular one, and made it bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
M30. M30's a tank engine, too. They handle a lot of boost. The resulting car was dubbed the 3.0 CSL. The 3 was for the leaders, and the CS was for competition sport, and the L meant liked or light.
I wanted to be competition sport liked in high school as well. Maybe a little too much.
So this wasn't light like some homologation cars that meant they just tossed on a set of Recaro knockoffs. This was the real deal. They used thinner steel to build the actual body of the car.
Okay, then
they deleted all of the trim and soundproofing, bolted on aluminum doors, an aluminum trunk, and hood, and put in Perspex windows.
Oh, nice. Okay, so synthetic, not glass. Mm. Okay.
And as is custom with amazing cars built outside the United States, it was not available in the United States.
Look, we're certainly guilty of this. I feel like every other episode of Up to Speed back in the day was like, and it wasn't available in the U.S. Mm-hmm. We don't get cool stuff. And look, a lot of that was my fault. I will take the blame on that.
You did the chicken tax?
No, I'm just saying like...
Writing it into the scripts?
Nolan's like an r/cars dude for
a
while, I
for
think.
For sure, yeah. Like your typical internet guy where it's like, oh, this cool thing, we don't get
have
it.
A manual for
what was me? Meanwhile, like we get some really cool cars in our own right.
Yeah. We absolutely do. We made a whole D-list about it. Amazing cars
that
the U.S. got that nobody else got.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
My joke was more that you were like, and part of that is my fault, as though you're responsible for these cars not coming here.
I made that decision.
You made a legislative decision.
I said.
The most striking option on the homologated versions was the borderline ridiculous aero kit. This is why they called it the Batmobile, because it had this massive spoiler, front splitter, incredible looking car, super slim profile, very long. There was an oversized air dam, fins on the front fender, a roof spoiler, and a Batwing-esque rear wing that was so tall. The Batwing-esque rear wing was so tall that German police banned it from the roads. But BMW
she
shipped the cars.
Have the wing. That's my German accent.
Give me the wing.
We will not have the wing on our roads.
You cannot see outside the rear window.
Get the wing off of our Autobahn. But BMW shipped the cars with the wing stuffed in the trunk, just in case you wanted to risk the ticket.
Nice.
They did that with the E36 M3 lightweight as well.
No
they
kidding.
Have the high kick spoiler that you see was an extension that they would give you the little
extendos legs
that you'd put on there.
Interesting.
And so they, some of them have them, some of them don't.
Okay. Hmm.
The 3.0 CSL was wildly successful at the European Touring Car Championship at the Deutsche Rennsport Meisterschaft.
Nice.
The Group A races that led to the inspiration of pretty much every decent racing game. Drivers of the 3.0 CSL secured the driver's title victory six times in the years 1973 and 1975 to 1979. The homologation version of the 3.0 CSL even went head-to-head against full-bore race car versions of the Ford Capri and Porsche 911 and did pretty well, at least better than most other Group A cars did.
Cool.
As motors grew, so did the competition. BMW deployed their carefully crafted 635i in 1982 as a direct response to the Jaguar 12-cylinder and the larger Mercedes V8s. The pedestrian versions of these cars sold like hotcakes, and homologation was achieved in time to field the car in an increasingly challenging Group A field.
We need to talk about what these look like.
Yeah, the 635i is... that's a dream car of mine,
it's
I think.
It's beautiful.
Bucket list, two-door Grand Touring BMW... bit of a big, heavy car. And that's something that we referenced at the beginning of this episode. It is a heavy car, but it is so good looking.
The liveries during this time. Mm-hmm.
John Player special.
The shape during this time. I love it. You know I love it. It's great. They're just so good looking.
There's something you said about, I guess, this is all around the time that aerodynamics were really becoming like seriously researched and everything. Mm. And, I mean, these days, there really is only a few, we'll say, shapes that we know are super aerodynamic and super performance-based and kind of force all the manufacturers either to choose one of these shapes for their own cars, and that's kind of like why all the cars look so similar in the market these days.
Coke bottle
But back
design.
Then, because they were still figuring things out, they could take big swings and lead to cars that look like this.
Mm.
But neither Benz nor BMW could see the writing on the wall as Audi rolled into town sporting all-wheel drive Quattros that changed the game from displacement to cornering. As Audi absolutely decimated the competition on the rally circuits, BMW and Mercedes refocused on Group A racing, specifically DTM, where they could lock in the title of Best German Builder. Mercedes dropped the 190e Cosworth in 1983, and BMW was still sitting behind the wheel of a large coupe, getting lapped by a compact car that had serious gumption with little girth.
What?
I mean, we can all relate to that, right?
Yeah, look, son, you may have the gumption, but you ain't got the girth.
You ain't got the girth. I feel sorry for you because you ain't got no girth.
Girth over gumption, know what I'm saying?
Hey, look, just like how...
I like gumption over girth.
How hard work always beats talent when talent refuses to work hard.
Mm.
Gumption beats girth every time.
That was good.
Beautifully spoken.
Look, you might not have the girth, but if you got the gumption, you can make things happen. I'm speaking from the heart here.
I agree. This is a great locker room talk. No, just like you, I just imagine you going in for your...
We may not have the girth,
but goddamn it, we got the gumption.
And you can tell that none of us went to school that had a football team. With that one, none of us had a football team. We know nothing about locker room stuff.
But despite the lack of girth, win after win eventually led BMW to call in the M crew and build them something better.
Something with girth.
Yeah, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Okay, so BMW is fed the f*** up with watching watching the 190e Cosworth fly past their 635 eyes and decided it was time to take action. But because of Group A rules, they had to produce a car that they could sell at least 5,000 units of. That's so much.
It is a lot. Mm-hmm. Usually it's like, I don't know, 1,500?
Now it's like 250 sometimes, depending on whatever. So they took a long, hard
girthy look
at their offerings. Grab the anemic and decidedly ungirthy E30 sitting on the bottom rung of their lineup and rolled it into the BMW M Workshop. While M had done some fun stuff, they were recovering from their not-so-stellar performance with the M1, the supercar, which only got a few wins in its 4 years in Group B. The E30 opportunity was just the chance M needed to get back into the good graces of the BMW overlords. So, they started with the engine. M grabbed one of the M88 inline-six engines they designed for the M1, then lopped off two of the cylinders to turn it back into what was basically the M10 engine designed by von Falkenhausen more than 20 years ago. Obviously a gross oversimplification, but...
just chopped off a couple of the cylinders.
It started as a four-cylinder, then turned into a six-cylinder, but now we're back to four-cylinder.
Mm-hmm. Just like we talked about earlier.
That's what we're saying. That's right. So, M had learned a lot when developing the M12 F1 engine, a turbo four-cylinder motor that could produce 1,400 horsepower, making it still the most powerful Formula One engine in history. Using what they learned from that engine, they started souping up the M10 for homologation cars. That's insane, dude.
Mm. Wow. 1,400 horsepower.
Yeah.
It's like 350 horsepower per cylinder.
That's my Hoffmeister kink.
You're waiting for that one.
I was waiting for that one.
Obviously, BMW couldn't put a 1,400 horsepower in the hands of regular consumers. So,
Jesus, can you imagine? Sorry.
So they chilled it out a bit by unbolting the 5.5 bar turbo, which is probably like, 50 PSI?
5.5, that's 79
PSI. And made it, quote, really great instead of eye-peelingly powerful. With 2,302 cubic centimeters to work with and four valves per cylinder, the inline four made a whopping 200 horsepower, which was less powerful than the 944 Turbo's 220 horsepower and the Ford Sierra Cosworth's 204. But as we mentioned before, the secret of the M Workshop success wasn't just power.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
The M engineers got to work chopping apart the E30's body, started crafting new bits out of fiberglass and plastic. They cut a new lower front splitter and installed a rolled rear apron and sill panels. They also widened it out a bit and flattened the C-pillar and trunk lid to lessen drag. The trunk on these cars looks really strange. They glued in the windows instead of using rubber piping and overall dropped the drag coefficient from 0.38 to 0.33, basically going from a Honda Prelude to a 300ZX. Mm. 0.33 is decent.
Mm.
It's pretty good.
Simplify and add girth.
That's right.
BMW.
Then M looked at the suspension of the E30 and pretty much ripped all of it out. They hooked up offset control arm bushings, completely redid the front strut tubes, and took the front wheel bearings and calipers from the E28, along with some bigger front and rear slotted discs or rotors, all hooked up through stainless steel lines. This little monster, the M3, showed up to the races at the 1987 World Touring Car Championship and the European Touring Championship and secured first places with ease. From 1987 to 1990, the first-gen M3 racked up win after win across races with Group A rules. And homologation was no problem because the M3s flew off the showroom floors. Thanks to the M3 winning races from the Nürburgring to Japan, the M3 was truly tested in sport and proven in series. But, much like the wars of attrition between the police and police radar companies, strange example, BMW and Mercedes began bashing heads as they brought their Group A cars to all new heights, evolution after evolution, which is where we'll pick up next week for part three.
Ooh.
In part three, BMW versus Mercedes and Group A, we'll look at the holy golden era of Group A racing that inspired the best performance cars ever to grace showroom floors. If you're a big German head, you're going to want to tune in because it's going to be good. It's going to be good. Now, we got some listener mail. Christina.
All right. It was mentioned in a video that you guys might have a bit of dog hair in your cars.
You could say we got a little bit of
that. Hey, we have a little bit of dog hair in our cars. A great way to remove it is to wear a latex glove and run your hand over the carpet or upholstery.
Hmm.
It balls it up so you can pick it up in a clump and make a new dog. I added that part. Happy cleaning. Love all donut content. David K. in PA.
Thank you, Dave K. in PA.
Thanks, Dave K. in PA. It is a good, I wonder if this works with cat hair, which is my problem.
Yes. Oh, I'm going to try this tonight.
Yeah, it's collectively all of our problems, actually.
I've heard of using a balloon, because it's the static, I imagine, which is what the latex is doing, and a balloon is extraordinarily staticky. Little detail hack.
I mean, that also, you know, makes life a little more fun and colorful.
That's good.
You use a little party balloon.
I can't remember the last time I played with a balloon, so I got to get on that for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I always keep zip ties and balloons in my glove box.
Yeah, so you can kidnap clowns. Okay, thank you so much for listening to Pass Gas this week. I always appreciate, I get into the analytics. And sometimes it escapes me how much the show has grown, and I'm so thankful. I love the medium. I love podcasting. I love telling stories, and I love doing it with this crew here in this very building. We got Christina Felsky. Follow her at Christina Felsky on Instagram. Max Maddox, you know it. You got to follow Max at Max Maddox. And we got Nick Giamuso and Gavin Kinzel in the studio today, and we will see you next week for part 3 of Group A. Let's go.
You. Wee-oo.